Hello, I'm Andrew Scrivani.
And I'm Chef John. Welcome to the Chef John Podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to the Chef John Podcast. Oh, my goodness. We're at the end of the summer, John, and I can't believe how fast it went.
I know. Like, time flies when you're dangerously overheated, like the whole world is.
Oh, man, has it been a hot one. I mean, I know we're not supposed to talk about the weather, John, but...
Well, that doesn't count. That's existential.
I mean, if you physically, like, just spontaneously combust because of the weather, is that a weather conversation?
That's too hot, yes.
Okay. Just making sure, because, man, we need to do two more podcasts, John, because I need to pay the bills.
Well, let's do it. Let's sneak in a few more.
Okay, great. But we also need to do a little housekeeping, right? Because we always like to begin the show by reminding our audience that it's because of you that we gather here to talk about these things, and we love hearing from you. So there are so many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at Chef John Pod, and you can help us spread the word about the podcast by retweeting or regramming us. And why don't you just leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice and give us what, John?
A 5-star rating would be nice. And if it's not too much trouble, maybe type some words, some comments into the, I think they call it the comment box, and tell us what you think. We officially want to hear about that, definitely officially. But unofficially, I think the algorithms just like that people react and interact. And so, you know, we're all about the technology and barely understanding it. So to summarize, leave a rating. And while you're clicking that button, you're right there. Just type in a little something, something.
I have a new paradigm for this that I want to share with the audience, because I believe this might put it in a little bit of a capsule that they understand. We want a 5-star review and a comment. So let's just call that a 6-star review, right? So like, we need to just up our game. We don't want just a 5-star review. We want a 6-star review. And that comprises of a 5-star review plus a comment. How do you like that?
I like it. I refer to it as a 5-star review with benefits.
Ooh.
But we can go 6-star review if you want.
Okay. Well, one or the other will suffice. And of course, finally, you can leave us a message on our website, thechefjohnpodcast.com, or even better, leave us a voicemail and we may feature it on a future show. Because, man, we're starting to develop some celebrities in that voicemail box, huh?
Oh, yeah. We are?
Yeah, there's a couple.
Okay, I'm excited. I mean, I don't check these things. I've never been to the website. I've heard good things.
In certain circumstances, you might call it a stalker, but, you know, we have fans. You know, we call them fans.
I was going to say it's a gray area.
It is, but you know what?
We'll take our chances.
We're going to take our chances, and we're going to call them fans.
Short for fanatics. So it really is close to stalker.
Absolutely. Okay, well, it is Labor Day coming up, and, you know, that's the time when, you know, we wrap up the barbecue season and we send the kids back to school, but it's a big food day. I'm always very excited about Labor Day because it is sort of like that big last blast barbecue outdoor thing that we do before we start, you know, letting the cool crisp air come in. So do you have any big plans for Labor Day, John?
Not really. I'm going to try to think of what are the things that I wanted to grill and or barbecue this summer that I didn't get to. I'll do a little inventory. We'll see. Maybe there's some things that slip through the cracks. Which reminds me, when you're grilling asparagus, don't put them parallel to the grates. People, go perpendicular. Unless you're doing some kind of weird, like, sacrifice to the asparagus gods. In fact, someone asked that in a vet I was at. Some grill master was doing a demo. And someone said, how do I prevent food from falling through the grates? And I was thinking, well, first of all, what food are you talking about?
Right.
Like, why are you grilling bay shrimp? Yeah, that's why they're falling through the grates. The spaces are bigger than your product. But anyway, no specific plans. I'm going to try to figure out something while it's still... Oh, wait. I just remembered something.
What's that?
I can grill all year here.
All right. You live in California.
Never mind. But in support with the rest of the Food Wish Nation and the Chef John Podcast audience, I will try to think of something for the end of summer that will be very, very nice.
The other day I was at a barbecue and the person who was barbecuing had thrown a whole bunch of shrimp right on the grates, just like you just described.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on standby with a pair of tongs. And as each individual shrimp was starting to slide in between the grates, I would grab it out and throw it back on the grill. So like it was a 2-man operation. It turned out okay, but the reality was probably way more work than it was necessary.
Yeah, probably throw a skewer through those things. And
yeah, don't get all chefy on me. I know, but you know, we were dealing with amateurs here, so it was okay.
And thank you for having a second pair of tongs and not trying to grab the actual host tongs, which is the biggest breach of barbecue etiquette ever.
No, no, I would never do that.
No matter how bad that food's coming out, you have to just grin and bear it.
Yeah.
Never grab a person's tongs who's cooking you lunch, even though they're burning it. And you're like, oh my God, can you please turn that thing over? It's, you're killing me. You can't, you have to go, oh yeah, it's looking good.
I wowed everybody with my homemade baked beans, which happened to be your recipe.
Oh, the best ever baked beans?
Best ever.
Well, we cheated. We just put three times the amount of all the ingredients and it worked out. Did you put the requisite couple pounds of meat in there to cheat?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The meat and the sugar.
And people are like, wait, is this a main course? Or and that's what's ironic about that recipe. And I probably just used ironic wrong again context. But it actually has probably the least amount of sugar of any baked beans recipe I've ever seen. And it still is plenty sweet enough because you need a certain amount. But some of these, you watch some of these videos and some of these recipes, there's two cups, like two pack cups of brown sugar and all the rest of the stuff we put in. It's like, I don't know, candied beans.
Well, I have to admit, John, I doctored your recipe a little bit.
Well, as I hope you would.
I did. I added more sugar. It was delicious.
That sounds good.
Okay, John. Well, that brings us to our first segment. Things that drive Chef John crazy. We're bringing that one back because we haven't heard or driven John crazy in a few weeks now. So, John, what drives you crazy?
Well, I've been pretty, pretty under control lately. So we skipped that segment. But a recent visit to a certain establishment that will go unnamed, I was handed the dreaded iPad menu.
Oh.
Now, I'm all about technology, and and in fact, I'm having sort of vague memories, and maybe I've mentioned this before, I'm not a fan, but I like a chalkboard, I like paper, I'm even okay with the server just telling me what's on the menu. Now, I will space out after the first two or three things they say, and then just ask if they have things, but what I don't enjoy is an iPad. For so many different reasons. First of all, everyone in the restaurants touched this iPad and I can't get up to wash my hands after every single time I got to look at them. So that's one thing. Second of all, as dirty as the iPad screen itself is, the leather or leatherette cover that goes over it is always even more disgusting.
Oh, yeah.
So just safety, sanity wise, it's not a great idea for a restaurant. And then it's just the annoyance of, I don't want to swipe and pinch and zoom and look at a iPad menu. Did I say iPod?
You did. And it's okay because Apple has recently retired the iPod and we're not going to be far behind.
Because, the only thing worse than an iPad menu is an iPod menu. Excuse me, sir. Would you like to listen to our specials? So anyway, I don't like the iPad. I feel like a grumpy old man whenever I get one, I get upset. Inside I smile and pretend it's not a problem. Because that's how you have to behave in public. But I don't like it. I understand. I guess we're saving paper. Is that what we're doing?
Maybe.
It's for the trees and the children. I don't know. But anyway, please, restaurants of the world, print your menus on some recyclable paper or just walk up with a chalkboard. I'm cool with that. Totally recyclable. But I do not want your iPad, especially since if it comes for the menu, I'm pretty sure they're going to try to make us pay using this thing.
I know this segment isn't about what drives me crazy, but you know what? If we share the crazy and there's twice as much crazy, I just think it's a better show. I'm going to tell you, every time I see an iPad in a food establishment, it's going to cost me more money because apparently it doesn't even have to be a food establishment. I feel like I went to my hardware store the other day and bought screws for the shower. And then I was asked if I wanted to leave a 15% tip. I am tired of tipping people for things that have nothing to do with service. Now, I absolutely believe in tipping your server, but man, when I go up and I just order takeout and I go to pay for the takeout, yet I have to tip somebody for ringing me up at the register.
I forget what I bought the other day. Same thing happened. A place never in a million years has anyone ever left a tip, but then you're paying and you have to skip that screen. That's like, would you like to do a custom tip or leave one of these percentages. Like, where's the choice for, you know, I'm buying cardboard. I don't think I'm supposed to tip here. So anyway, it is something I could see that would drive you crazy.
What about presumptuous tipping, where it starts at 20% and goes up to 30%? I get those as well.
I've done that before. I've left a nice, generous tip.
You are a good tipper.
Took after my father, was always a good tipper, said, even if you don't have money, tip good. People will think you have money. And a couple times, maybe after a few too many cocktails, you leave the place. And then later on, you realize, or maybe you look at the receipt and you're like, did I tip after that 20% was already added to the check?
Yes, exactly. The technology is definitely creating that.
What's so funny about that is I'm not one of these tip on the subtotal jerks. I go bottom line. Bottom line, that's what 10% is. That's what 20% is. So not only did I tip after the tip was already tipped on the tip, I tipped on the total, including the tip, and then gave him a tip.
Wow.
So if you were there that night at whatever restaurant I'm talking to, maybe next time I'm in, free appetizer or something. But anyway, the point is, we don't need these iPads in your establishment. And if you are going to put one at your counter, if you're selling me stamps or whatever, have a nice big button that says just finish paying or something.
I have one other question, John, while we're on this topic, because since we've already waded into these murky waters of tipping, I'm really confused about how to tip bartenders. You know, like back in the day, right? You would tip a bartender $1 per drink.
Yeah, that was like the standard.
Yeah, that was pretty standard. And now that drinks are like 15 and 20 bucks a pop, at least in my city. Well, your city too, when you're in San Francisco. What do you tip a bartender these days?
Well, you know, and I don't know if this sounds self-serving, but I do tip 20% on bartenders usually. Here's one thing though. To avoid that, I just eat at the bar a lot of times.
Okay. But you're tipping $4 on a $20 cocktail?
Yes.
Okay.
If I have to do the run the card, here's the iPad or here's the swiper thing, usually it's added to the check, so you don't have to really worry about it. And if I'm at a bar and I'm paying cash, then you have, we call it the Scrivani out. You just can still leave a dollar because you got the cash in your hand.
I don't know that I want to own that, the cheapness there. I don't really want it named. Yeah, I don't want that named after me. No, I
don't. Of all the things they could have named after me, they named a way to avoid tipping.
No, because I'm not that guy.
No, you're not.
All right. So no iPods. iPods. Now I'm doing it. You see, you're infectious, man.
I am.
You are totally infectious. You infected me. I've not said the word iPod in at least a decade. And now I'm mixing it up with iPad.
Well, let me finish the segment for you then. Bottom line, we do not want our menus on iPad.
John, we're bringing back a segment that I know we all love. And I know for a fact that you do not know my fun food fact tonight. I have a fun food fact that I think I'm not sure anyone knows because it was a complete surprise to me when I read it. Did you know that cheese is the most stolen food item in the world? In fact, it is stolen so much that it has its own percentage. About 4% of all cheese made around the globe ends up stolen. There's even a black market for cheese.
I'm surprised it's only 4%.
Well, wait. But where are you getting stolen cheese?
Well, people are walking into cheesemongers and just putting a wedge of cheddar in their pants, I guess.
Okay. I have a theory on this. The municipality would be like giving away cheese to all the families at the school or at the church or whatever. And we used to get this big block of cheese because when I was a little kid, we didn't have a lot of money. And what I'm thinking is that municipal cheese, because it's thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of that cheese, ends up falling off the truck, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then the cheese ends up on the black market. How's that for a theory?
No, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And I know, I think I saw a segment about Parmesan production, and that was actually a problem. You know, one of those wheels is worth how much? Like,
yeah, right. That's right.
So, you know, that was actually a fairly easy thing to steal, like a pickup truck, you smash through a fence and you got a couple of wheels of Parma in the back of your Range Rover. So no, that does not surprise me. I don't know if I'm just getting, you know, cynical, jaded, but I always, whenever I hear one of these percentages, I'm like, oh, that's not bad. It should be more. But only 4%, that's pretty good.
But you would think there's so many other food items that would be worthy of stealing, no? What, I mean, if you had your druthers, what would you be stealing?
Caviar.
You're right. something expensive, right? Now, cheese could be expensive, right? But this is not accounting for all of the cheeses, just the expensive cheeses. It's accounting for all cheese, right? And so some cheese is less expensive than other cheese. But caviar, there's no cheap caviar.
I'll give you a little homeless shoplifter tip.
Okay.
I have this on a reliable source. Can't give out my sources, but okay. Very extremely reliable. Cheese, like caviar, I guess, cheese is the most calories you can steal and put it in your pocket. A pocket full of cheese could be up to like 1,500 calories.
That's a great point.
A pocket full of bread is 200 calories.
Right.
A pocket full of meat, you can't eat right then and there. But a pocket full of cheddar, you just extended your life 3 days with that just quick little boop, boop in the pocket and you're out the door. Also, your charcuteries of the world generally don't have your hard-ass security guard walking around like, hey, hands off.
Imagine that's your job. Charcuterie security.
Take your hands off our salami. Please.
I think we got to come up with a screenplay called Charcuterie Security and just write a whole story about the guy who's in charge of guarding the cheese because it's the most stolen thing in the world. This is amazing. We need to create this story. We need to write this story and pitch it to Hollywood because we have the statistics on our side, John. We have them.
And on the poster, it will say, stop, that's nacho cheese.
Hey, you stole my joke, man. I wrote that. You stole it right off the document.
I'm going to be honest. I didn't trust you to deliver it properly. I think I nailed it. So let's get over it. Do you know that 4% of all punchlines are stolen? That's quite a coincidence.
It's quite a coincidence. But I'm going to say it anyway. That's not your cheese.
See, you did screw it up. You said that's not your cheese. That's nacho cheese.
And that brings us to our favorite segment here at the Chef John Podcast, Pairings, where we discuss what we're watching and what it makes you want to eat. John, what are you watching and what are you eating when you're watching it?
Well, I am almost finished. There's one episode left. I believe there's 8 episodes in the series. It's a little something called Irma Vep on HBO. Are you familiar?
No. I mean, I've heard it, but I have absolutely no concept of what it's about.
You will absolutely go nuts over this because it is 95% inside filmmaking minutiae. Let me set it up for you. Then you'll be like, oh, that's why I would love it.
Okay.
So Irma Vep is a character from a 9-hour long movie that was shot in like 1900-something French film called The Vampires.
Okay.
Which of course was Les Vampires. And Irma Vep is actually an anagram of vampire. And Irma Vep was the head vampire's henchman. And by the way, kids, this is a really inspiring story because if you're a young girl out there and you did not think you could grow up to become a henchman because of your gender, Irma Vep is a role model for you.
So we have to reinvent the word for henchman.
Yes, she broke the blood ceiling or whatever you want to call it for vampire henchmen. But anyway, Irma Vep is like a evil hench person. I guess we'll just go with hench person. This was a cult classic movie. I think it was from 1996. That was one of those movies about a movie being filmed. So this series on HBO is this same director, Olivier. He is re-envisioning this for HBO with a modern version, with all the modern movie set trappings and tropes and all the, you know, cliches, etc. And it is super entertaining, and it is just chock full of insider jokes, you know, like archetypal characters that you would see on every set from the wacky art director to the crazy French, you know, actual director who's on antidepressants, but is doing okay, but not that good. And then the actress who I think is probably patterned after Natalie Portman, or at least that's what it reminds me of. She kind of has that look and feel and vibe.
Well, she's played by Alicia Vikander, right?
Yes. One of our finest Swedish actors of today. I just found out she was Swedish. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes.
I had no idea.
She's a great actress and she plays a great actress trying to not only channel the actress that played Irma Vep in the 1996 film, but also actually trying to literally portray Irma Vep, the vampire henchwoman.
Wow.
And then they do flashbacks to the filming of the original vampires, like done in that time is like a flashback, but it's played by the characters doing the newest version that I'm watching on HBO. So there's so many different like layers, and you're not sure like what's real and what's not. Like at some point she walks through walls, but they don't make it clear, like, is she really doing that? Or is that a metaphor? Or is she feeling like she's lost touch with herself versus the character? Like,
this sounds what we call meta, John.
It's very meta. And I've only been on a few production sets, like three in my life. No movies, all television. But I totally get all the sort of inside jokes and the, you know, the divas and the, you know, the innocent bystanders and the screaming at assistants for no apparent reason because it's, you know, why is there mayonnaise on the sandwich? And just like the relationships are fascinating. So I think you'll love it as a movie industry insider. And I think anyone would like it just as an entertainment vehicle. And my pairing, because a lot of the show is these actors basically living in hotels during the shoot in Paris. So, of course, I'm thinking living at a hotel. What's the greatest thing about hotels culinarily is room service.
Right.
And what is my favorite room service meal? No, not mashed potatoes. It is the classic, iconic club sandwich, which is so funny. You will verify this because you've been in a million hotels. Almost every hotel will have a club sandwich on their room service menu, but they almost never actually have it on any of their other menus.
That's true.
Like a burger, a club sandwich, and a grilled cheese sandwich or toasted cheese sandwich is on so many room service menus, but they usually don't appear on the regular menus. I always found that was kind of interesting.
You know, but it's such an easy sandwich to make and make great, right? Yeah.
And it's impressive. You feel like, oh, I'm getting a little bit of vegetable. There's some lettuce and tomato here. So I am a huge, huge club sandwich fanatic. Club sandwich and a side of mashed potato. And I, you know, just kill me. I'm going to heaven.
That's a weird combo, but okay.
No, oh man, you don't knock until you try it. I mean, what is mashed potatoes if not unfried French fries still in a solid wet form? I mean, it's just really close. But no, I love the club sandwich. And whenever I see them in the hotel, stuck in the hotel, killing time in the hotel, I'm thinking, you know what I would do if I was them? I'd order a club sandwich.
That's perfect. I mean, it's right on point.
So yeah, I have one more episode to go and then I'm done. But I highly recommend it.
John, you've given me so many great shows to watch. I mean, I'm barely catching up and you've given me another one that I absolutely have to put in the queue. So I'm going to kind of turn back the clock tonight for pairings because it would be negligent of me, especially in the age of streaming services, not to harken back to history because my favorite show, and maybe the favorite show of many, many people, is MASH. The entire catalog of MASH is on Paramount Plus, which was originally a film by Robert Altman back in the 70s that became a hit television show for many years on CBS. And it happens to be my favorite show for a lot of reasons. I mean, number one is the absolute craft in which it was executed. It's a fantastic show. It always sort of touches on both the comedic ridiculous on top of the profoundly sad realities of war. So MASH stands for Mobile Army Surgical Hospital and stars Alan Alda, among others, where they are surgeons in the middle of the Korean War. If you've never watched it, and I mean, you're most likely aware of it no matter where you are, no matter how old you are, you've heard of the show. But if you've never actually spent time watching it, or if you haven't watched it in a really long time, you need to go back and watch it again. Now, for me personally, other than the fact that it's one of the most critically acclaimed shows to ever reach television, I have a personal reaction to this show that is twofold. Number one, is I always watch MASH with my dad. And my dad tangentially reminded me of Alan Alda in a way. Like my dad has dark black hair when he was a young man. He had deep blue eyes and he's around the same age and he really loved the show. And we used to watch it together. And my father is still with us. My father is still a healthy 75-year-old man. But I know that long after my dad is gone, if I'm here and I sit down and watch MASH, it's always going to bring me closer to him, because it's something that even now when I watch it, it makes me think about my father, right? So I love the shows. I can watch them in rerun. It's great storytelling. Many years go by, I haven't watched MASH in a long time. And then I am in my marriage with a Korean person. And my wife's family was basically created because of the Korean War. Her mother is from the northern part of the country, and she migrated to the southern part of the country during the war. And I learned an awful lot about the war from a different perspective and what it meant for their families and how it tore families apart and how the accuracy of that show really told a story that was very interesting. So I ended up watching the show again later in life and had a profound different experience in watching it and understanding it from the Korean perspective. So from watching it with my dad as a kid, I got this perspective of, you know, what it was like to be an American soldier. My father was a serviceman in the Navy. And then I got to watch it from the perspective of my mother-in-law as somebody who was like one of those refugees coming down the dirt road with all of their belongings in a cart being pulled by an ox, you know, understanding what that must have been like. So it really had such a deep, profound effect on me in my life and connected me to people in my life. And that's what good art does, right? Good art really connects you to a lot of different perspectives. It connects you to a lot of different sort of ideas and understanding of things that happened, you know, almost 20 years before my birth. So you really need to go back. And if you've never seen it or you haven't seen it in a long time, go to Paramount Plus and watch MASH again. My pairing for this is bibimbap. Now, bibimbap is a Korean dish that a lot of people are familiar with, which comprises of rice and vegetables and meat and egg. And it's all sort of put into a hot stone, which is called dolsat bibimbap. And basically the hot stone sort of scorches the rice at the bottom. And then you put gochujang, which is a Korean chili paste, on top. And you stir it all up together with your chopsticks and a spoon. And it just makes an amazingly warm, hearty meal. And it's a special kind of a dish. And it's sort of very flexible because you can put different things in it. And if you want to try to make this at home, you want to go and buy one of those stone bowls, because then you can put that right on the stovetop and like scorch the rice and put all the other ingredients in top and then sit in front of your television and watch MASH end to end.
Love it. Love the pairing. One of my favorite things to eat in a Korean restaurant, of course, like most normal people that have had the pleasure of being in that situation, that's a must order. And MASH, you know, one of my favorite TV shows growing up, that was like the golden age of television, All in the Family, MASH, just great stuff. And, you know, both parents worked all day, all night, raised by television. And of course, young teenage Chef John, big fan of Hot Lips Houlihan.
Yep. Loretta Swit played her on the TV show and she was fantastic.
Great show. Must watch if anyone out there has not seen it. Follow my good friend's advice and go check it out immediately.
That's great pairings, John. Modern, which harkens back to old days, and then old days, which makes it more modern. We're in complete sync this week.
Meta.
John, we have so much fun with the top five list. And this week, I would love for you to go first and let me know, what are your top five food combinations?
Top five favorite food combinations is an impossible list to create, obviously.
It is. It is totally impossible.
So I tried to go with some iconic and also some maybe a little bit more esoteric. But here we go. Number five, French fries and ketchup. So good together. So perfect. I mean, any kind of fry, crinkled cut, regular, shoestring, any kind of ketchup, spicy, sweet, Filipino style banana, like you name it. It's just a perfect pairing. And with some of these pairings, I'm going to take it up to the global level. Above and beyond that specific pairing, the pairing of a fatty fried food with a cold acidic condiment is just a timeless food combination. Literally anything that comes out of a deep fryer, just crispy on the outside, smoking hot, dipped in any kind of cold, bracing, acidic, whatever kind of dressing, condiment, sauce is instant perfection, texturally, temperature-wise, and almost always flavor-wise. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a pairing. But yeah, French fries and ketchup, one of my all-time favorites, or as my Italian friends like to say, French fries with American sauce. Which brings us to number four, toasted bread and butter. Now, I got specific here because untoasted bread and butter is fine. It's good. I'm not turning bread and butter down. But toasted bread, for the very practical reason of I need some friction. I want a crusty surface with which to scrape that butter off the knife so as not to tear the crumb, which is just a, you know, borderline crime against nature. So as far as just an iconic combination of foods, bread and butter, classic. But toasted bread, you got that nuttiness, that extra umami, Maillard effect that comes from the browning of the product. And then you put that butter over. And again, like the French fry and ketchup, there's something about the combination with foods of something that's completely lean and 100% fat-free with something that's 100% fat. That just is a can't-miss combo. Which brings us to number three, Manchego cheese and Membrillo paste.
I don't know what Membrillo is.
Okay, well, I'm a little bit embarrassed for you, but I'm going to explain.
You should be.
This combo, and this is my obviously my most esoteric inside baseball pick.
You definitely went inside baseball here.
I didn't want to go with something, you know, obvious like cheese and crackers. Now, for those of you that don't know, Manchego is a cheese. It is one of the most delicious cheeses in the world. And I know the Parmesan people, ooh, king of the cheeses. Manchego is every bit as delicious and savory and just cheese-making perfection as Parmesan. I will argue that with anyone that wants to argue. And what I love about Manchego is that it's not a hard cheese like Parmesan. It's softer. It's firm. It's very firm. But it does have those little salt crystal pockets in it like a good Parmesan. And it's a sheep's milk cheese. And if you're a cheese nerd, you know what that means. As a sheep has a very specific, just really savory flavor. But as good as that is eating alone, there is something called Membrillo, which is a gorgeous ruby red paste made from a reduction of quince. Now, quince is a giant apple-looking fruit. It's the size of a softball. It is completely inedible. In fact, don't try to eat it. You break a tooth. It's hard as a rock. But if you cook it for a really long time, it gets soft. It breaks down into this pink pulp. And then you keep cooking and you keep cooking and you keep, and you add sugar and you keep cooking. And eventually it cooks down to a paste that's like this gorgeous pink-red substance. And then you chill it. And the natural pectins in the fruit solidify it. And it's so firm, you can actually slice it. And what you do is you take a thin slice of this Membrillo and you lay it over a nice, not so thin slice of Manchego. And that is Mount Rushmore food pairings because it has everything in that one bite. It's got the sweet, the savory, the salty, the sour, the bitter. I mean that literally. And I know only literally 1% of the time people say literally, they mean it literally. That's literally a fact. And this time it's literally one of the top food combos of all time because obviously all those words I just said work together. Like sweet always works with salty and savory always works with sweet and savory at the same time and salty and bitter. You got to have a little bitter. So that little bit of bitterness from the cheese, how it's cured. I believe it's done in like a grass woven basket. That's why it has those really distinct marks on the rind.
Yeah, right. That's the crisscross rind, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
I know a lot of you probably have had Manchego, but go, they sell it in the same cheese stores. It's always in the corner where you've never looked at those products where they keep the olives and the, you know, the anchovies and the whatever. You'll find a package of Membrillo. Try this combo and then leave us a comment that that wasn't one of the greatest things you've ever tasted in your life.
You all have homework now.
And if you ever have to bring something to a party and you want to just put no effort into it, you want to just completely phone it in, buy a piece of Manchego, slice it up, or just bring it whole, get a wedge of hunk, a block, whatever it comes in of Membrillo, bring that and it will be the hit of the snack table. And by the way, it's super easy to make. I don't know if I'll, you know, bore anyone with a video for it because it will get like 7 views, But if you ever see quince at a farmer's market or a neighbor has a quince tree, which they have no use for this fruit, trust me, they would be happy to give you a bucket of quince. Google a recipe for membrio. It could not be easier. And you will be tasting one of the great unknown foods of the world and by far one of the great pairings of the world. Which brings us to number two, rice and beans. One of the great combos of all time. If there's a cuisine on earth, a culture on earth that has access to beans and rice that hasn't put them together, I got to wonder about this culture. It is such an incredibly perfect combination. Again, you got your sort of lean end, and then you got your little more satisfying, meaty, heartier component. Doesn't matter what kind of rice or what kind of bean, it always works. Wet, dry, baked, boiled, like you name it. Now, the only thing I can never decide is, do I like beans and rice more with the beans intact? Or do I like them where the beans are smashed, refried style, so that you can sort of mix it into the rice? Always one of my dilemmas when I decide to do a beans and rice side dish or something. Am I going to smash beans or am I going to keep beans intact? I love beans and rice. I will order, you know, a plate of food at a Mexican restaurant just to get the beans and rice. And then, you know, the meat's an afterthought. Like I could live without the meat. I'll eat meat later. But sometimes I'm just craving that starchy, beautiful, perfect side. Which brings us to number one, mashed potatoes and gravy. This comes as no surprise to anyone who's listened to the podcast. Mashed potatoes is one of my all-time favorite foods, if not my favorite food. And as far as a pairing, it doesn't get any better than a real, actual gravy poured over into and on top of those mashed potatoes. And when I say a real gravy, please let me explain. I'm not talking about a sauce. I'm not talking about any other just flavorful liquid you've thickened up with flour or cornstarch. I'm talking about a real gravy. And there's only one true real gravy. That is a sauce made from the rendered out meat juices and fat from something you've cooked in a pan or a roasting pan or whatever. It doesn't have to be on top of the stove. And you take that incredibly flavorful fat, and then you stir flour into that to make a roux. And then you add whatever your flavorful liquid is. Ideally, it's a stock made with the same bones as you roasted. And then that is an actual gravy. Everything else is a sauce. When you take some chicken stock and whisk some roux into it or some cornstarch, you know, it's a nice thing, but it's not really a gravy. And I'm guilty of this. I'm sure I've called things gravies just, you know, semantically incorrect, but just because it served the purpose. But a real gravy has to be the fat from the meat thickened, and then you got a gravy. And that over mashed potatoes, I could eat that every day for the rest of my life. I don't know how long I'd last, but I could do that. No problem.
And you know what? With your final explanation of what gravy is, I like constant validation that tomato sauce for Italians is called sauce and not gravy.
And by the way, I think you explained why they call it gravy and it had nothing.
Yeah, no, I've been down.
It had
this
nothing
road.
To do with the ingredients. It was just like, we want them to like us.
No, I just want constant validation. I want to hammer this point home at every opportunity.
Well, yeah, and I totally agree. It's only appropriate to call gravy if you're eating your spaghetti and red gravy with a fork and a spoon, like real Italians do.
All right, John. Well, I mean, I got to go over your list because I'm very impressed from a few different perspectives. One, of course, is that you took some of the most basic things that we eat in our culture, realizing just how much we love just the simple things, right? The simple things is what we get a lot of joy out of. And something like French fries and ketchup, my goodness, man, there are days when I just like go to a restaurant. I don't care what else they're selling. And I will go there just because I want to have their French fries and I want to dip them in some ketchup. So absolutely 100% on board with that. And then of course, as somebody who has struggled with dealing with eating real wheat, I really miss a great piece of bread and amazingly salty, delicious butter, especially toasted. I love bread. I grew up on really good bread. And there are times when all I want to do is have some toasted bread and butter. I love it. It's so good. I'm so happy that you put these on your list. Now, number three threw me a little bit, John, because I've been involved with food for almost as long as you have. And membrio is something that has never crossed my path. A manchego cheese I'm very familiar with. But now I'm completely intrigued. And now I'm hoping that wherever I go next, I'll go to some specialty market in New York or...
Any grocery store has it these days. Whole Foods carries Membrio.
Is that true?
Yeah, Safeway has Membrio. It's always at the end of the cheese or charcuterie section where they keep all the odds and ends.
Okay.
You will almost always see some Membrio somewhere near there.
I'm always looking for something to show off my little bit of food skill. And now I got a new tip from Chef John here that I can actually put into play. So absolutely, Manchego and Membrio will be at my next dinner party. Beans and rice, John. I mean, this is a staple of cultures all around the world. You know, depending on what culture you come from, there's different twists on this. One of my favorites happens to be the Dominican restaurant in my neighborhood in the Lower East Side. And I love their beans and rice. I've eaten a lot of different places. I've eaten a lot of different kinds of foods, but their beans and rice always seems to be the thing that keeps me coming back. It is something that will sustain you, and it's cheap and it's delicious and it's a great thing to eat. So I'd love to see that on your list. Now, of course, mashed potatoes and gravy is the most anticlimactic number one on a top five list that ever really existed in our universe, at least the Chef John podcast universe. So you surprised no one with that choice. But nonetheless, I could have made my list. But of course, out of just deference to your complete and utter devotion to mashed potatoes, there was no way I was going to put anything mashed potato related on my list. All right. So my top five list, there's a lot of classics on here as well. One that you already previewed and kind of submarined on me, but it's okay. It's okay. At number five, macaroni and cheese. Now, macaroni and cheese has lots of forms, right? You can go Kraft in the box. You can go artisanal with lobster and whatever you want to put in it. But any combination of macaroni and cheese, including things like baked ziti or lasagna, right? Those are all macaroni and cheese at some level. But I understand that most people associate macaroni and cheese with like sort of a cheddar sauce and like elbow macaroni. But I'm going to expand that to include any type of macaroni that is accompanied with any type of cheese. It's just such an amazing combination of starchiness and delicious sort of textures and the savory aspect of cheese. So anything macaroni and cheese, definitely high on my list. And that brings me to number four, John. Chicken and waffles. Chicken and waffles is something I can't even eat anymore, like because of my issues with wheat. So there's a place that I eat at here in town that makes an amazing, amazing gluten-free waffle. It rivals any waffle you can eat, right? But they don't have the chicken to go with it. So I have to find a place that's going to be able to satisfy this need of eating chicken and waffles with a beautiful, like real pure maple syrup on top. Oh, it's so good. So audience, please, if you know anywhere in this country, in this world, I will travel for a really good gluten-free chicken and waffles. Just hit me up. Let me know or send it to me. Something. Just, I need this.
So let's make this happen.
Please. I beg you. Number three, we have cheese and crackers, which of course, John just submarined and said something as mundane as cheese and crackers. But cheese and crackers can be a Ritz cracker with some cheese whiz on it, or it could be some Manchego on an artisanal cracker. But the reality is it's so flexible because it doesn't matter whether you are highbrow, lowbrow, somewhere in the middle, there's always a cheese and cracker for you. That brings us to number two, the breakfast of champions, bacon and eggs. There is nothing that makes me happier on a weekend morning coming down to my kitchen, frying up some bacon. I got a new technique. One of my favorite things to eat. I know it's not the healthiest thing in the world, but I limit myself to, you know, only once in a while, but it is something I could still eat and still enjoy. And I have a new technique, John. I don't know if you know this technique. I put the bacon in the pan and then I cover it with water. And I cook it until the water renders all the fat out. And then it cooks in its fat like it would normally if you just put it in a dry pan. But because we've already rendered the fat in the boiling water, now everything cooks evenly, the fat and the muscle. So now you get perfectly crispy bacon straight through. How about that for a technique?
That sounds scientifically very sensical. And if I try this and it works, I will 100% do a video for that and take credit.
Awesome. And the other thing I do with a fried egg is I fry the egg and I cover it and steam the top. Just a slight membrane over the yolk.
That's a must do.
Totally perfect.
And you're cooking it in the bacon fat, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Just checking.
Yeah, I'm there with you. Okay. My number one of all time, chocolate and peanut butter. The delivery system is inconsequential. It could be a Reese's peanut butter cup. It could be in an ice cream sundae. Doesn't matter. Chocolate and peanut butter together, greatest combination of all time.
I tend to agree. That is a great, great combination, but I'm going to hold off on that one because I'm going to critique your list.
All right, let's do it.
Well, first of all, macaroni and cheese, one of my favorite foods to eat. So that's a classic combination. I am semi-particular about my mac and cheese. If I would ever follow someone's recipe, I would almost always double the amount of sauce, cheese you're mixing with the pasta, because there is nothing worse than a dry mac and cheese, where it looked kind of creamy and loose when you first put it in the oven. And by the time it's baked and the top is crusty and it cools, we have macaroni with nothing inside them. So if you're going to make mac and cheese, people, make sure you put enough of that cheese sauce when you mix it in. By the way, fun fact, you know who brought mac and cheese to America?
Nope.
A Mr. Thomas Jefferson.
What?
Yeah, look it up.
Wow.
Which brings us to your number four, which I could not disagree with more.
What?
Chicken and waffles is a borderline crime against nature. First of all, the last thing I want to eat when I'm eating fried chicken is some other fatty, fried, carb-cooked, crusty on the outside, soft in the middle food product. I've never understood chicken and waffles. I'm annoyed by chicken and waffles. Whenever it's on a menu at a brunch place, I'm always like, can I just get the chicken? Because I can't just get fried chicken at a brunch place.
Why don't you just have them put it on separate plates?
No, that's cheating. I think the waffle conflicts with the coating of the chicken. Just texturally, I don't think it works. Now, I'm all about putting, you know, some kind of jacked up, tricked out maple syrup on fried chicken. That sounds pretty good. And I'm fine with savory foods eaten with waffles, bacon to foreshadow. But fried chicken is such a specific and perfect experience. I do not want my fried chicken waffled. And this is something I'm not waffling about. I am 100% serious as a heart attack you'll have after eating chicken and waffles too many times. Now, as you've heard me admit many times, there's no right or wrong with food. Whatever your least favorite food is, that's someone's favorite food. They can't get enough of it. So I would never, you know, look down upon a chicken and waffler, but it's just not something I enjoy. And I've never understood the popularity of it. Above and beyond, we are really drunk. We're still hungover, or we're still drunk. It's not even a hangover yet. And we're in either the all-night breakfast place or just open breakfast place. And we are just smashing a giant plates of chicken and waffles. That works in that context. But as far as a food pairing, I am not a fan.
Okay. Well, you know what? We agree to disagree.
Yes, we do. Cheese and crackers, of course, no disagreement. A classic pairing, any kind of cracker, any kind of cheese. Although it will come as a slight, maybe surprise to you, my favorite version of cheese and crackers is the bright orange cheese cracker in the vending machine with that little impossibly thin slice of what they say is cheddar cheese, but it's really just a spread of salty spread with artificial cheddar flavor in it. And that is something I just enjoyed from the time I knew there was such a thing as a vending machine until today, where you just can't find those anymore. But yes, cheese and crackers, I'm a huge fan of. Very good. Bacon and eggs, of course. Classic combination. We'll eat it anytime, anywhere. Got to cook your eggs in the bacon fat, of course. Always put a lid to finish your eggs so that the albumin on top finishes. The boiling to render first, I think that makes sense and will work. The only hesitation I'm communicating here is that we're still cooking the bacon. It's still boiling. It's just not pan frying. It's just not maybe getting as crustified until it gets that head start and then it can fry.
That's right.
That part I'm down with, but the bacon is still boiling with the fat. The meat part is still cooking.
Yeah. It's still cooking, but it's not fully cooked. And then it just crisps up at the end.
Sure. No, I'm going to test it.
Yeah. Test it and then take credit for it because, you know, you have a career to uphold.
Yes. Sustain, uphold, hang on to, whatever you want to say. And then chocolate and peanut butter. great combo. Amazing story of how it was discovered. Someone was on a bike, I think they were running, and they ran into someone that had an open jar of peanut butter, and the chocolate bar went in. And
I just think that was a commercial.
Oh, really? That was not the. Well, that's disappointing. Okay. I thought that's how it happened. But anyway, chocolate and peanut butter. It's got to be for me dark chocolate.
Oh, interesting. I'm a milk chocolate guy.
Okay. Whatever. Do your thing. And the peanut butter's got to be smooth.
Yes. I'm down with that.
Yes. And in fact, one of my go-to late night feeling lazy, but want something sweet, but something semi-healthy snack is a tablespoon of peanut butter that I will then sprinkle. And by sprinkle, I mean completely cover in dark chocolate chips. And then I will eat it like a popsicle.
Oh, wow. That sounds delicious.
Now, don't tell me you have not thought of that yet.
No, I mean, I just haven't done it.
Well, you're welcome.
Segments on the Chef John podcast have shelf life. And I think our expiration date on this last segment has reached its expiration date. So we're going to finish up strong and we're going to have one more episode here of Who Do You Want to Eat With? We're going to retire it for a little while after this, and we're going to give some variety to our audience. It's well within our foodie sort of purview to put expiration dates on things, right?
You don't want it to spoil.
No, you don't want it to spoil. And what we want to do right now is give you one last who you want to eat with. So, hey, John, who you want to eat with?
For my final who you want to eat with, I'm going with a local boy, rags to riches story. Well, actually not. Not super riches to riches story. Everybody knows him from Triple D, Drive-Ins, Diners, and Dives. Or is it Dives, Drive-Ins, and Diners? I go with Triple D because I can never remember. But my good friend who I've never met, Guy Freddy. Now, before I get into this, and one of the reasons I picked him, what's the deal with him putting a T in his last name?
I don't understand it. Like, I'm studying Italian. I'm from the culture. And I've never understood how he pronounces his last name.
Because I've heard that name pronounced that way. That's not him. Like, I'm pretty sure that's actually not just him doing that. So I don't know if it's just maybe it's a family thing. Because my Italian side of the family pronounced a lot of words with an extra thing. Polenta was polenta with a D. Like, where did that come from? So maybe that's what it is. Now, why I pick Guy? First of all, he is appearances and maybe superficial judgments aside, one of the nicest guys ever from what I hear. And I have some very reliable local sources. When you're talking charity work for fire victims, whether you're talking marrying like hundreds of same-sex couples in a single ceremony, he's an officiant. He's apparently a super cool guy. I've never had the pleasure of meeting him except for one time.
Okay.
In Atlantic City, when I first started my career, it was like the first food show I got sent to where I got a free ticket. That was the infamous trip.
This is when you stole a limousine.
This is where the infamous trip where I sort of stole someone's limousine and was sued shortly thereafter for $4 million. True story.
What episode is that, guys? Go back and listen to that episode.
Yeah, definitely want to check that one out. It was the most insane things. But anyway, he was at that food show and I only knew him. He had just won the next network star. And he was the biggest foodie at this particular, you know, event. And at that time, he wasn't like an international star. He was just the most famous person in that room. So I came up with my little, it wasn't even a smartphone. It was just like a little 2 AA battery recorder. It was like a recorder, like you use for voice notes, only it like took really bad pixelated video. So I see him. I'm like, you know what? I know he has no clue about Food Wishes. At that time, I had you know, maybe 10,000 followers. I said, you know what? Nice to meet you. Shook his hand. He was serving some kind of food. Oh, it's delicious. Would you mind? I have a food blog. I'm kind of just getting started. I have no famous foodie friends. Would you just say hi to me on this quick video clip? Anyway, without missing a beat, the guy goes into like, he's known me all his life. Check out Chef John at Food Wishes. One of my favorite blog. Just this guy is the and this and that. Oh man, he does it. And he did like 3 minutes. Totally unsolicited, unrehearsed, he's just a natural. And I was like, wow, that was like super cool. And of course I went and posted it. I was like, oh my God, you know, Guy Frey's a huge fan of the show. So anyway, I always had a soft spot in my heart for him, but never knew. Is he a cool guy? Is he a jerk? Is he just all, you know, but then I found out over the years, he's a very cool guy. He's definitely made an industry out of that show. So I would like to eat with him and trade some war stories and find out a few behind the scenes, political intrigue at Food Network.
Sure.
And get him to verify a few theories I have about a few people there, which I will not go into during this podcast, which I probably should for an episode.
Well, we'll save that for next season.
But anyway, and he's a restaurant owner. So anyway, we would just, a 3-4 hour dinner would just go like that when we were telling all our war stories, many of which would be true. So anyway, that's my who I would like to eat with final edition.
I don't watch a tremendous amount of food television, but I have heard nice things about him. And he got absolutely torched by the New York Times. And I Yes. felt kind of bad for the guy. I thought it was uncalled for and I thought it was a cheap shot. And honestly, to find out that he was actually a really nice guy and then got that kind of treatment kind of made me feel bad. So I'm happy. Maybe you get to repay the favor, pick up the check for a guy. After he did you a solid back in the day before Food Wishes became what it is today. So I really like that choice. I think that's fantastic, John.
Yeah, and he almost ended up having to be a character witness in my trial. I'm glad that didn't come to pass. But anyway, yes, Guy, if you're listening, which there is a slight, small chance you might be, if you ever want to actually make that meal happen, it's on me. And we'll actually go to one of your restaurants and eat. How about that? Because then they probably wouldn't bring a check. But anyway, I've got this all worked out. All right. Who are you going to eat with?
Who I want to eat with is a callback to our pairings. I have regaled you earlier about how much I loved the show MASH and how Alan Alda reminded me of my dad. So Alan Alda is the person I would love to have a meal with. And it goes beyond the show. The reason is Alan Alda is also a complete and utter science nerd, a lot like me. He has been forging his way beyond being just a Hollywood star and somebody who has had all kinds of success on TV and in films, but also has been the host for 14 years of Scientific American Frontiers, which is a TV show. And then beyond that, he even pushed it further. And in 2010, he became a visiting professor at Stony Brook University, which is here in New York. And in 2009, he was the founder of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. And this is a man who is now in his 80s, who has a highly successful podcast called Clear and Vivid, and it's about science communication. So on top of the fact that he is one of the most beloved characters in the history of television, he's also this figure who has never really stopped evolving as a performer, as a person, as a learner, as a teacher. And I really identify with a lot of those things. And I really would love to know him. He went to Fordham University. I'm sure he has a lot of great New York stories from back in the day, being a person of his age. There's so many different things that I feel connected to Alan Alda about. I've never met the man, but being a New Yorker, being Italian American, his actual name is Alfonso Joseph D'Abruzzo. So Alan Alda is a stage name that he inherited from his father, who had an even longer, more complicated Italian name, who is known as Robert Alda. And they shared the screen together in an episode of MASH. So I am deeply enamored with Alan Alda as a person, as a performer, and I would love to share a meal with him. I'm sure we could go up to Arthur Avenue in the Bronx and have a really great Italian meal and talk about things forever because he's a fascinating human. So in my final, who I want to eat with, Alan Alda.
I'm going to admit to being slightly disappointed. It was not Halib Sulayhan. Mr. Alfonso Joseph D'Abruzzo is a fine choice. And fun fact, my cousin, Nicholas Quattaro, was actually the football coach at Fordham for a too short a brief period of time. So just want to throw that in there. Hey, Nick, if you're listening. Yeah, no, that would be a fascinating meal on several levels. You could do drinks and appetizer talking about MASH. And then main course dessert, talking about the rest of his interests.
Absolutely. Perfectly broken down.
Well done. Well done.
And that brings us to the end today, John. I would love to know, what did we learn today?
Well, we learned so much. The audience, maybe not so much, but we learned a lot about each other, which is really what this is all about. No, that's not what it's all about at all. What we learned and what I learned, I had no idea. Alan Alda, big time science nerd.
Mm-hmm.
I am a closet science nerd. I love science. If I wasn't watching sports or food televisions laying on the carpet as a kid, being babysit by the television, I had some kind of science show on, some kind of PBS. This is like way before Discovery Channel, but then that came along. That was always the default channel surfing landing spot. We also learned that if you're down and out, down on your luck, literally starving, and you have to steal some kind of food, we're not saying it's right. We're not saying you should. If you have to, you want to go with cheese. You can fit about 2,000-3,000 calories in both pockets. It is, of course, a victimless crime because there's plenty of cheese where that came from.
Plenty. 4% globally.
Don't hurt anyone getting it. You got to, in the pocket. And please don't leave it in the pocket too long. You know, unless you got some bread, you're going to put that melted cheese on. So yes, cheese, apparently we learned, is a very commonly stolen product. The most stolen food, according to you.
Yes.
Our fact checkers will work on this. And if you ever end up on a cheese-related trivia show and they ask for the percentage of stolen cheese, it's 4%. And if I ever start a secret society, it's going to be called the 4%.
The 4%ers.
And then last but not least, I think the most valuable tip we learned today. If you don't want to get stuck over-tipping a bartender, make sure you're carrying some cash. You can drop down a crisp dollar bill for that $14 Manhattan. And you can sleep good at night. Even though you just tipped, like, what is that, 6%? It's fine. Everyone's okay with it because that's what we used to do, dollar per drink. And then someone said, hey, I got an idea, iPads. Let's just start the bidding at 25% and hope they can't figure out how to get to the custom tip button where they can just put in a couple bucks and make it a little more realistic. And by the way, you bartenders out there do great work. All the BS you have to listen to from people like us sitting there telling you our troubles, no amount of earnings makes that worthwhile in my mind. So well done, bartenders of the world. We're, of course, doing all this tongue in cheek. Don't forget to tip your servers. Tip them well. They will take care of you. And, you know, good karma. You can't get too much of that. So let's end on that positive note. And speaking of positive notes, I think we're only left with one thing to do, and that is say goodnight, Andrew.
Good night, Andrew.